Why do I need to go to church if God is everywhere? And I can find God in nature, on top of a mountain, or in the ocean. We're going to talk about why that question is a cop-out and how you actually can find God everywhere, and finding him in church and in nature both help you enjoy the other more and become more fully yourself. More importantly, we're going to talk about how to today on The Chris Stefanik Show.
I tell people who are nervous going to confession to me, I was like, I've never heard one as bad as the one I gave at 17. So don't worry about it. It was an egocentric life, chasing the moment, chasing the perfect climb up the mountain, whatever it might be. You're just in it and you're going deeper and deeper in it, but it's not satisfying. Then I started to look for, like, how do I break deeper into the reality of things? And that's when I started doing psychotropic drugs.
The first person to celebrate Mass on the top of every one of the 54 14ers.
It's amazing. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. The summit of the faith, the Eucharist on the summit of a mountain. I don't think it gets better than that.
Welcome to The Chris Stefanik Show. We are here every week to give you the tools and inspiration you need to live your everyday life with joy. If you want daily inspiration, no strings attached, click below this video and sign up for the Daily Anchor. Also, I want to thank our missionaries of joy who make all this work possible, and this episode is sponsored in part by EWTN. You can catch this and so much more on EWTN Plus streaming. See the link below this show in the notes. So you may have gotten the comment from people before, dude, why do I need to go to church if I find God on the top of a mountain? Okay, I have a couple of answers to that question. Number one, yes, God is on top of a mountain. God is, frankly, everywhere. So is water. Your body is 60% water. And yet, you go to a water fountain, right? Number two, why not both? I think that question is the biggest cop-out ever. Why not go to nature and spend an hour a week at church? It's not like those things are mutually exclusive, but this is the most important thing, guys. You should go to both. Because when you go to nature, you learn how to be more human again, and you encounter God in a unique way. When you go to church, you start to see nature through the lens of being a gift from a creator who loves you, and doing both those things actually helps you enjoy life more. Each propels you to the other, and I'm so excited to dive into this today with a true mountaineer and a priest. I'm here today with a priest who is exactly like Father Mike Schmitz, only smarter and slightly better looking. Oh, the gloves are off. We just did that.
Yeah, buddy.
He's going down. No, I'm kidding. I love Father Schmitz, and I love Father John Nepple, vice rector and professor at St. John Vianney Seminary in Denver.
That's right.
Our hometown. One of the, what, 1,000 or so people to summit all the 14ers of Colorado.
That's true.
54 of them.
Yep.
And it's not that, how many people? It's under 2,000.
The number is the registered official account.
Okay.
So we don't actually know, but yeah, it was something like 1,300, 1,500, something like that.
But most importantly, the first person to celebrate Mass on the top of every one of the 54 14ers.
That's right.
In Colorado.
That's right.
How epic is that?
Yeah. It's amazing. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. The summit of the faith, the Eucharist, on the summit of a mountain. I don't think it gets better than that.
There's some times where I envy priesthood. That would be one of them.
Yeah.
Right? Another one, leading pilgrimages to the Holy Land, the priests who go into the tomb.
They
come out and like, hey, that's...
I could dig that. Yeah.
That's a moment.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I... buy this book. I love this book about the experience of hiking through the Colorado Trail and summiting all these mountains. I agree with Archbishop Shabu in the foreword. I didn't expect to like this book.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, I love his straightforward style.
Yeah.
And he's just like, you know, he didn't think I'd like it. I grew up in Kansas, didn't think I'd care. But when I first saw it, I thought, okay, this is like nice for people who are best friends with Father John and like want to hear his random letters. It's a series of letters written from a hike.
You're right.
Like, what can this do for me, you know? Not to inflate your ego, but this is up there with Belloc's Path to Rome.
Thank you. It means a lot.
And I really literally mean that.
Yeah.
Like, this is an incredible book. It just, wow. You started with your own childhood and how your dad brought you into the mountains. And there was one story where he said, son, tonight you're gonna learn a valuable lesson.
Yeah.
All right, so tell me about that story.
Yeah, so
some of your first memories, which would have me running from the mountains anyway.
Yeah, 12, 13 years old. My dad's a West Point Army Ranger career mm-hmm. officer. Great guy, nicest guy like in the world. But like he knew how to form character and grit in his sons. Mm-hmm. And so we get to the base of Mount Elbert. I've never done this thing called climbing a 14er. 14ers are 14,000 foot peaks. We have 54 of them. Colorado is kind of the center of the Rockies. And it's the rooftop of the Rockies here. They're all situated in about a 50-mile radius. It's just like everything kind of comes to the heights right here in our backyard. Hmm. So these peaks are they're kind of a thing to hike or climb, depending on the technicality. We went up to do Mount Elbert, my first one, with my dad and brother, and get into the tent and kind of digging through the backpack and looking for all the things and realize, like, very quickly, frantic, panicked, no sleeping bag. And my dad had told us, like,
wait, how
it's
old were you again?
Cold. Probably like 12.
Wow.
Yeah. And he said, pack, you guys, make sure you pack everything. Check your bags before you leave. And it was early September, so it was starting to get cold. The nights were getting cold. And we were at 10,000 feet at the base of the mountain. And we sat in that night, and I was like, how do I look as pathetic as possible to elicit this paternal empathy, which surely my dad will say, you know, we all make mistakes, and this is a great moment for me to kind of sacrifice for my son. Oh, no, no. I was like, Dad, I forgot my sleeping bag. And he goes, son, tonight you're going to learn a life lesson. And that was the first of many life lessons for making mistakes. I start that story because it was the worst night of sleep in my life. I didn't sleep at all. Just laid there with my jacket around my legs. Got up at like 5 to hike this thing, which just goes forever. Mount Elbert's the highest peak in the state. Mm. And it's got several false summits. So you get up to it and you think this is the top, not the top, not the top. And this is before iPhones. This is before any kind of technology. So you just have a book that says, go up here, turn right here. And so you have no idea.
If you're actually in the right place.
And I was like, this sucks. This is like the worst thing I've ever done in my life. I hate this. I'm never doing this again. And I just kind of came down. I was like, that was awful. Never doing this again. Fast forward. Here we are.
You did it many more times. Years.
Yeah. Many, many more times. Yeah. Fell in love with it.
Wow.
Yeah. I came down the mountain that day and then just discovered something. You tasted something. Above tree line, there's a spot at 12,000 feet where the oxygen is so depleted that there's no vegetation. There's no trees. They just literally stop. It's pretty wild. It's eerie. But the transcendence, the view, the power, the majesty of creation from that spot, I was just in love.
Yeah, I feel bad for my friends from Kansas because there is something above tree line that's eerie is the right word.
Yeah.
It's otherworldly.
Yeah.
Like everything sounds different
up
there.
Yep.
It's incredible.
The sound, the feel of the air, the temperature is dramatic, and it's just a sudden thing. You just walk out of the trees and it's just nothing.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
So despite that miserable experience at the age of 12, you kept going back by yourself with friends like when you were in high school. Was this something that you were constantly trying to get up there through your high school years?
Yeah, it was. And it was simultaneously I'm moving towards deeper into the backcountry, getting into different kind of adventure activities with some buddies in high school, and also drastically moving away from my Catholic upbringing, like as fast as possible.
Yeah, what did that look like for you?
Well, I grew up with a Catholic family. Great mom and dad. I mean, I make them sound awful. They're going to watch this and be like, really? Thanks, man. Throwing us under the bus. But they were a classic kind of boomer Catholic who grew up in a culturally Catholic place. Mom in Minnesota, dad in Montana, farm communities. Mm. There's a simplicity to their faith, but there wasn't a working knowledge and an ability to communicate that. And we've talked about this for many years, and my dad's now a deacon, and you know my parents.
Oh, yeah, you celebrated Mass with your dad, which is the coolest thing
yeah,
ever.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So things have come full circle, but it was a bunch of rules and ideas, and it just felt like this repression of my freedom and my ability to live my life as I want on my own terms.
Wow.
And so one of the questions I brought into the book was, what was it about those early years where I was in the backcountry, but I wasn't finding God? Because I think that's the experience for a lot of people. They have a spiritual experience. You know, you hear all this, I'm spiritual, but not religious type things. That's a lot of people that are in the mountains, that are in Colorado. And it's a crisis of worldview. That's kind of what this book tries to serve. It tells the stories of these adventures, but it's really about, like, how do we get and form Catholic, young Catholics not just by doing all the externals, which I never interiorized. I just had to do them. You're going to Mass. Why? Because we said so. Okay. You know, you don't do this, you don't do this. There's a bunch of prohibitions. It was just the law is what it felt like. And I was like, I'm ready to get out of here and get away from this church. And then you start to hear all the kind of Marxist and kind of Nietzschean critiques of institutions. And I was in a public school where I was just kind of, you know, everybody starts dabbling in existentialism in high school. I guess not everybody, but I definitely did. And
most normal kids actually don't start dabbling in
existentialism. Exactly. Okay, so I did that.
Deeply thinking kids do.
Yeah, started to kind of formulate ideas. And so the first couple chapters of this are really unpacking what is the secular worldview that we find ourselves in. If you just follow the path of least resistance and you're not actually evangelized as a Catholic, what is actually taking place in terms of how I think about reality? Because that's what a worldview is.
It's striking that Summit County, where so many of these mountains you hike are, and it's so stunning, has almost double the national suicide rate.
Yeah.
It's when you have that existential angst, and then you're looking for beauty and saying, please let there be more, and your conclusion is there's no more.
Yeah.
That's the moment of despair. But you were looking for more in the mountains. Were you conscious of the fact that you were looking for more? That what your parents were raising you with wasn't working? Or was it more just, hey, I just want to get away?
Yeah. It was, I would say I was not very self-aware as an adolescent, but I was definitely searching. Big time.
Okay.
Looking for something deeper. Because what was happening was there's a kind of pressurization to teenage existence that can happen where it's just like everything's cutthroat, academics, competitive hockey. You get locked into this world. And what I found was a real escape from that.
Mm.
And I think that's what was driving me deeper into adventure and doing crazier and crazier things. And that was kind of the trajectory I was on. And I detail some of this in the book, and also stories of people who could have been me, who died doing whatever type things, just pushing it to the max. I think that there's a lot of intense people out there who are looking for that kind of escape into the backcountry. But I was also discovering something deeper and more real that I was looking for. So it was like trying to fill my life with something new, but also it was mostly an escape. Yeah.
Were you a phone addict? No,
probably not. I didn't even have a phone.
Okay.
Yeah, like this is like late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, okay, this is the difference.
Yeah.
Now when kids expect, now I made fun of you with existentialism, but everybody does in their teenage years have an existential angst.
Yeah, yeah.
And now usually when they experience it, they just numb the pain with, oh, I'm just going to scroll.
Yeah. Because
you want to numb pain.
Yeah.
And we had to just literally sit there in pain.
Yeah.
Why do I exist? Yeah. I got to think about this.
Yeah, I remember getting my first phone. I was like a junior in high school, and it was one of these block Nokia phones. Remember, you could like change the cover. Oh,
yeah,
you had was Snake on there. There was a game called Snake. It's like the dumbest thing ever.
Yeah, it wasn't going to do
that's not going to do anything. So you have to literally face it. Yeah.
And you went to the mountains.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that led you to faith. What was the connection there that you were making that other people go to the mountains and end up despairing sometimes,
and this is where I hope this book will tie together two different things. One is this deep kind of insatiable desire that we have to be immersed in creation, not just the mountains, but just in general. Just we want to be immersed in the reality of creation because it's this more real in a lot of ways. Silence and stillness and solitude and the beauty, it's almost like it magnifies life, I feel like, being like really immersed in the backcountry. But what I don't want to do is play that against the institution and especially the structure of the sacramental reality of the church, which is what brought me to Christ. So I did not meet him on a mountaintop. I met him in the depths. This book's called The Heights and the Depths. I met him literally sitting outside of a Student of the Rockies conference because I left, and I was sitting on a concrete sidewalk in the middle of a city, and a priest came outside and talked to me when I was 17.
So the mountains were teeing you up?
Mountains were teeing me up.
How?
I think that it was breaking me. It was bringing the questions to bear. Because the way I describe creation is and the mountains is, they can awaken the questions. So fast forward, I'm 27. I'm now a priest. I'm the chaplain of the University of Colorado. I started bringing young people into the backcountry just because I knew that
it's all in there. The religious sense is a real thing. We're not just spiritual, whatever that means. We are religious, and it's a sense in us. There's a correspondence and a desire of the heart. It's just you got to kind of reframe the thing, reframe the situation of life, the circumstances, let it draw out. So I think the questions started to get awakened by this searching, by this moving more deeply into creation. But then it was priesthood, confession, Eucharist, bam, Christ. That's what it was that night.
I want to circle back to that conversation with that priest, but first I want to read something from your book, which again, I read and love the book. Get the book. You wrote, "The more I climbed, the more frustrated and disenchanted I became," which really struck me. "At the heights, I was glimpsing something real, but only for a moment. And then I returned home even more unsatisfied." And it made me think of my bride's conversion on a beach in Kauai.
I love that story.
Yeah. She looks around, gets an overwhelming urge to say thank you. She's thinking, who am I thanking?
Yeah.
And the worst moment for an atheist is when he wants to say thank you and has no one to thank, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't only that, like, this is so beautiful, there's got to be a source. It was also the angst of, please tell me there's a source. Please tell me there's more. This is pointing to something more, and that pointing is a deception if there's not something more. And that's what you describe here. I returned home unsatisfied. So you went to the height, and it's like, is there a greater height that this is pointing to, or is this a trick? Later, the author G.K. Chesterton would put words to my experience. Take away the supernatural, natural, and what remains is the unnatural. Unpack that last sentence for me.
Yeah. So the
and that angst you were feeling.
The angst and the fuller story is you start tasting these things, these experiences. Mm. There's a chapter called The Ego in the Moment, because it was all about, it was an egocentric life chasing the moment. Chasing the perfect powder line in the backcountry, skiing, chasing the perfect climb up the mountain, whatever it might be. And it becomes almost like consumeristic. So it's just like the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And you're just in it, and you're going deeper and deeper in it, but it's not satisfying. And there's this kind of diminishing return where you're just not getting what you're looking for, because it's not meant to be consumed, right? This is not a product. Creation is something that has to be reverenced. I talk about it, it's not useful to try and build up my ego or whatever it is. So then, and I don't talk about this in the book, but then I started to look for, like, how do I break deeper into the reality of things? And that's when I started doing psychotropic drugs.
Wow.
So marijuana and shrooms became part of our experience in the mountains, because I was looking for Jim Morrison, Break On Through to the Other Side. I mean, that's what it was.
I'm here. Please tell me there's more. I'm going to force this something.
There's
more.
Not more, so I'm gonna force it. Yeah.
Wow. I can't tell you how many guys. I'm like, I go skiing a lot.
Yeah.
And how many people are on the slopes now, and they're tripping.
Yeah.
On something.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, isn't the beauty around you enough?
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
It's not. It's actually
without God.
It's torturous without God. And this is why I think it's heightened in the Summit County. Crested Butte, Colorado, is a place where I spend a lot of time. Beautiful and terrible, terrible suicide rates and depression and anxiety. Everything's heightened because the tension of living in the beauty is so extreme and so powerful that I think it just pressurizes people without God, without something that actually transcends it.
So while you were in the mountains on shrooms and smoking weed, through that experience, were you starting to experience even more, this is not enough? Like, were you kind of aware because your upbringing, this is not right, this is not, because you obviously didn't want to keep going down that road.
Yeah.
You were conscious of it, but kept going?
Yeah.
Like, tell me more about the growing discomfort with, because some people become comfortably numb, because it's like, okay, I found the shrooms now.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Now, this is why you
have was it not good for you?
Well, I thank God for this, because the only option is to keep pushing into harder, harder drugs.
Mm.
So we had plans to move into some really intense stuff right before my conversion happened, which was right before my 18th birthday, going into my senior year.
What were you going to be doing?
Oh, we're just going to go into acid and just kind of more kind of hard line stuff like that. Moving away from more natural drugs, as we like to think of it.
It's hilarious that people are like, what's natural? So it's fine.
Oh, it's so awful. And I have... you know, I've talked a lot with, like, young people about drug culture and this whole kind of medicinal, and I know it's not our topic today, but it really profoundly made me a selfish man.
And so back to the conversion moment, I had to be saved badly because it wasn't just I'm this super nice, virtuous guy who just really loves the outdoors. It was like I'm becoming a deeply hardened, selfish individual.
Wow.
And my parents saw that. And that's where I think they said, we've got to do something. We've got to intervene in this kid's life.
So they dragged you to a Steubenville Youth Conference.
Paid me.
They paid you to go to a Steubenville Youth Conference.
Yeah.
How much did they pay you?
Like $500.
They paid you $500. And this is in the 90s.
Yeah.
This is inflation. This would be $1,500 today.
I owed them a lot of money for some legal situations that I found myself in. And so they were like, debts forgiven, Jubilee type. They were so desperate. And so we shifted. They basically...
God bless your mom and dad.
They're
watching.
They're the best.
Mr. and Mrs. Nepple, yeah. You're amazing humans.
They are.
Sorry, go ahead.
They are. But there was a moment of crisis in the family where they were like, we're losing our sons. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. Mm-hmm. Younger sister was still in middle school. But brother and I, Steve is always had a more moral kind of focus and compass. I was more of just, I don't know, kind of going off the rails. But they were like, we have to radically change our life. We're going to start going to Mass every Sunday. We're going to find the most dynamic parish we can. So we're going to start driving and looking around for this place. Mm-hmm. We need to get them connected with youth ministers, priests who can speak to their experience. We got to get outside of ourselves and start availing ourselves to what the church can offer. They all started to do this and put things in motion that then set us up for this experience. What happened? They called the parish and they said, we've got these sons, and they said, well, this is coming up. And they're like, they won't go to that. And the parish secretary is like, have you ever thought about just paying them? Do they owe you any money? Amazing. Amazing.
Okay, so here you are. Yeah. You've been looking to break through to the other side. The mountains left you longing. The drugs leave you longing. Your parents pay you. The conversation with the priest.
Yeah. So I was stoned the whole first day of the conference.
Wow.
That was my first plan. I was like, I'll take this money, but I'm not interested at all. And then what happened is, as it always does, the high wears off, the depression sets in, the anxiety returns, and you're left with yourself again. So we didn't have iPhones, but there's always something you can use to escape and try and medicate life, and it just is completely unsatisfying.
Wow.
So now it's Saturday of the retreat. It's a Friday to Sunday thing, and it's about 2:00 in the afternoon. And what's happening is there's just a real – my own life is starting to kind of manifest. Now I'm starting to kind of awaken to the fact of, like, you're actually pretty miserable. Hmm. You're living a miserable, selfish life. And look at the witness of these joyful people, 2,000 of them around you, obnoxiously joyful. And that's what started to kind of turn and open things up a bit. But it was the priest who came in with the kind of delicate and thoughtful direction. I needed to be directed, but I needed a very gentle hand. Because I have this facade put together, like I've got it all figured out, and I've intellectually refuted the Catholic faith and all this BS. But deep down, there's just so much pain and confusion.
Wow.
In a 17-year-old. And that guy, he was everything in that moment.
Who was he?
Jesus Christ. I don't know. I've never seen him since.
Wow.
He brought me into the confessional. We made a very long confession. I tell people who are nervous going to confession, I was like, I've never heard one as bad as the one I gave at 17.
Wow.
So don't worry about it. Don't worry. I promise you. I've never heard one. I've heard thousands and thousands of confessions. Never heard one as bad as that. So you're not going to shock me. And I've never seen him since, and I have no idea who he is.
Wow.
So that's one of these things that we wait for heaven on that.
Amazing. So the witness of that joy and just saying, okay, bah.
Yeah.
Were you aware that your life was changing in that moment?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I remember walking out of the confessional and just feeling this immense, immense sense of peace.
God is so good.
A lifting of years and years of just so much sin and pain and weight. Like that, the heaviness of sin is just, we forget that, what we're carrying. And I felt just immense freedom and joy, and things got simple and quiet in my soul. And I walked back into the conference and they were beginning this thing called Eucharistic Adoration. No idea what that was, but I was like, I just need to pray. And that was the moment. That's when I met Christ.
Wow.
In the Eucharist.
I love the word metanoia. Yeah. When Jesus said to repent, he's saying metanoia, change your whole mind, your whole outlook, your whole worldview, right? So now you're a converted person. And I'm sure a lot of the habits took a long time to quit, right? I don't know. Did you ever go back to drugs and slowly wean off?
Or was it
like, I'm done?
The guy showed up the day after. And then they're like, we're going to the mountains. And I was like, I'm done. I'm out. And I was like, I still have some weed and alcohol and stuff. You can come get it. They did. So I gave it to them and I was done. There was a fall about 9 months later. Fell back into it for a weekend. But I knew I could never go back. You just knew it, and you just drag your sorry butt back in the confessional and just say, okay. So that was the summer of 2001, and it was the most transformative and unbelievable experience of my life. I'm still shocked that this happened. My family
I'm sure
is
your
too.
Parents are too.
Totally shocked. So.
Best $500 they ever spent.
Yeah, so then we took it to turn it up to 11 for Spinal Tap friends. My brother and I were like, all right, we don't care about anything. We don't care about college. We don't care about anything. Our single focus is to become saints. This is it.
So your brother's too with you?
My brother had a conversion too that summer.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah. So he and I are like going back in. So now I got two guys going back to public school who are like the stoners of the school, who are like these crazy on fire Catholics who are obnoxiously getting after everybody.
And your friends are shocked.
Shocked. Everybody's shocked. And then we take it to the next level, and this is terrible theology, but this is where we're at. We didn't know anything. So We're like, the only purpose of life is to be a saint. And the only way to become a saint is to become a priest. So we're both going to seminary. Terrible theology. Terrible, terrible. But
I thought the same thing.
We literally...
I discovered I fell in love with the sacrament of marriage, then met Natalie, but my first reaction was like, I'm all yours, Lord. This is the way.
Yeah. And it's the idea of an serving with an undivided heart, but of course there's states in life and there's a particular call. It just took us a couple
whatever
years
he calls
to
you to.
But we both went to seminary.
Wow.
Somehow
incredible.
They accepted us.
Wow.
Like, they actually were like, okay. Like, like, I don't know. Like, now I'm on the full side of work in the seminary. I'm like, geez, man, I don't know. These guys are pretty raw. But we went to seminary. My brother the year after me, and after several years of learning how to pray and being kind of immersed in life, like, it was, the call was clarified that I was called to be a priest. My brother, the call is very clear. He's called to marriage.
Praise
He's
God.
Now married. He works in the church in upstate New York.
Hey there, I just want to share something really important with you guys real quick. You know what's crazy? This entire show, every episode, every conversation, every life changed only happens because of our supporters. The Chris Stefanik Show is powered by people like you, people who believe in spreading the joy of the gospel. Now, here's the deal. Each year, we reach millions of people, but there are millions more that have not received not just the good, but the great news of the gospel. We want to reach those people, walk with them, and that's where you come in. When you become a monthly donor, a missionary of joy, you're not just donating. You're actually making this mission possible. You're helping us bring the hope, truth, and joy of the gospel to a world that desperately needs it. And that's not all. As a missionary of joy, you get exclusive access to all our video series, including Living Joy, Rise, Renewed, Fearless, and more. You get exclusive early access to new releases. You get Monday motivation texts direct from me. And you get access to our daily anchor, daily inspiration to fuel your faith. The truth is, the gospel is too good to keep to ourselves. If this show or our work has encouraged you, challenged you, or strengthened your faith, imagine how many more lives we can change together. Don't just watch the mission, fuel it. Click the link below and become a monthly donor today. It'll be the best investment you make this year. You go back with a new worldview into the mountains.
Yeah.
And you drew out the distinction between George Mallory and Edmund Hillary's approach to the mountains.
Yeah.
And one is, I'm going to bag a 14er.
Yep.
Or I'm going to carve a wave. I'm going to tear it up.
Right.
And the other is a longboarder or a guy who's a pilgrim in beauty.
I like it.
Right?
I like it.
And is letting creation move him. Sum up the two differences.
Yeah.
Because you're going to get more out of creation with Edmund Hillary's approach.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so the two most famous guys to attempt Everest, the first one does it in the 1920s, this guy Mallory, has a very, I compare their worldviews. So Mallory is very much so a secular, modern approach, which is why, he says famously, he's asked by reporters, why are you climbing Everest? Because it's there. because it's there. But then he goes in, and I kind of talk a little more about this in the chapter, where he goes into specifically, we have to conquer this. Hmm. We have to climb this. We have to make this come under man's domination. Nature is meant to be dominated by man. This is modernity. This is how we think. This is how the Industrial Revolution begins. Excuse me. And so he kind of carries that spirit of the age to, we have to conquer this. Fast forward 30 years, sir, and George Mallory dies attempting the mountain. We don't know if he actually summited it or not, but he dies on the mountain with a companion.
Fast forward, Frankenstein, man. Try to conquer creation, it doesn't work.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you have Edmund Hillary, who in 1956 summits, and his approach is much more different. And it's not necessarily Christian, but it's not this kind of command and conquer the universe type modern mentality. And he has that famous line where he says, it's not the mountains that we conquer, but ourselves. Mm. So it's really about self-mastery and about the conquest that happens through hardship. And I think that's more of a direct lens that the Christian can enter into that more deeply. The first one, we can't really interpret that or understand that.
It's acting on creation versus letting creation act on you.
Exactly. The transformation of the soul that happens by being in creation, especially being challenged by it.
And letting being talk to you. There's another great quote from your book about letting creation speak to you and form you. With a Christian understanding of humanity, we gain a new awareness of how created things present themselves. We find them alive and speaking. And I think this is what gets into the metaphysics of creation, yeah? Mm-hmm. That you're letting being speak to you. And you're raising your intellect to learn how to read it and hear it, right? What does that mean?
Yeah.
What's the metaphysics of creation? And make it not scary.
Yeah.
Because people hear the word metaphysics.
Metaphysics. Yeah.
But you also share in your book, if you choose between steak and fish, you're doing metaphysics.
So that's my favorite story. That was a professor of mine named Giulio Maspero, this wonderful Opus Dei Italian priest. And he was describing metaphysics to us.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, we go to the restaurant this evening. It's so Italian to, like, everything's about food in Italy, you know. And he says, you go to the restaurant and the waiter says, steak, fish. You make a decision, you're doing metaphysics. Hmm. What he means by that is you're reflecting on the meaningfulness of things in themselves. Hmm. So the fish is meaningful as a fish. It means something. It is something. The steak is meaningful in itself. It's the reality as it presents itself. Hmm. The challenge we have in the loss of metaphysical thinking.
Define meaningful, though. Because people think meaningful, they think it's speaking to me in a deep way.
Yeah.
What do you mean by meaningful? Like
meaningful, meaning in itself.
Okay.
The thing itself is significant, intelligible, ordered, rationally thought.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a deep question.
Yeah.
What is meaning? Like an answer to it is like this is not simplifying it, but the word logos I talk about a lot. So Christ in the beginning was the word, logos. But logos really does mean word. It also means meaning. It means rationality. It means intelligibility. So the ancient understanding of meaning was word. This steak and this fish are presented to me, and it's almost like a word.
Wow.
And the word is the giftedness of love. That's if I could summarize what is this whole metaphysics of creation? What is it? Meaningfulness, all this stuff. It's all about gift. And that's what I missed before.
Wow.
I was in the mountains.
Can I stay on the structure like that? Steak for one
more
second?
I can stay on that. Yeah.
I think there's there's the thing that makes it fish is not just the DNA of the fish, right?
Yeah.
It's there's something immaterial, metaphysical, beyond physical.
Yeah.
That is fish about that thing.
Right.
Right? Just like you, even if you had your arms and legs chopped off, you'd still be human.
Right.
But that speaks to a whole spiritual dimension of life. And even a little kid says fish versus that in a way that animals can't. That the postmodern mind is missing in this like uber materialist scientistic worldview, right? Am I getting this right?
Absolutely, right on.
You know, Peter Kreeve wrote about the ocean, and if there's one gripe I have with your book, it's that you are more of a mound of dirt and rock lover than an ocean lover. But he said the scientistic mind, to talk about like the philosophy of scientism, not just a scientific person,
exactly.
But that reduces all things to, if it's verifiable with the scientific method, it's true, everything else is blah, 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 would look at the ocean and see lots of H2O moving around Whereas the pre-modern mind would look at it and see mystery and awe and spirits and life all interconnected. He said, well, which one's got it more wrong?
Yeah.
You know, the post-modern person is getting it totally wrong because you're missing that metaphysical spiritual reality that you that you're tapping into, learn to listen to.
So
sorry for the tangent. Pick up there.
No, good. I do want to say, while we're on the tangent, I think the Stefanics need to write, you and Natalie need to write the ocean version of this, because my buddy...
Sold. She's watching in the sound booth.
There you go.
Natalie, begin writing.
That's your task.
Good. Her fist is up in the air. Yeah. That's a promise.
I love her story. I love your guys' love of the ocean. I love talking about Hawaii and the experiences there. My buddy, Father Tim Danaher, who's the chaplain up at Dartmouth College, he's a Dominican. And as all Dominicans are, a little cheeky, you know? So he goes, this is the only great book you're ever going to write. He said, you peaked early, congratulations. And then he nailed me for, I have one critique of you. You don't pay attention to water. You think it's this cute little spot to put your tent next to. And he's like, this isn't a critique of your writing. This is a critique of your soul. Start paying attention to water. So I need your book.
There's something wrong with you.
Oh,
if you don't like the ocean.
He's the best. I love it. It was one of the best things. One of the best things. But yeah, back to the fish or the steak or... I was teaching third graders last week, my nephew's class, and I was talking about avocados.
Mm.
And they all loved avocados. I was very impressed. Very healthy kids at Lord's School. But I said, I remember when somebody taught me how to cut an avocado. Because I would just, I'm a terrible cook, and I would just destroy the whole thing. And I was like, there's a way you can cut it. You got to cut around it, and then you pull the center out, and then you kind of cut it in the cube. It's like, it's amazing. And I said, the point of it is that avocado has a nature. There's an avocado-ness to the avocado, and if you want to work with the avocado to achieve the end, then you gotta work with it according to its structure and form.
Wow!
So that was the I don't know if they got anything about natures or metaphysics,
yeah,
but they remembered the avocado.
That's awesome.
So there's something about the word-like structure, the meaningfulness, the significance of the thing in itself, and to your point, metanoia, which is the conversion of the mind. So conversion of the Christian life is fundamentally begins up here. We have to think differently if we're going to act and choose differently. And the way we think differently is, and St. Thomas Aquinas is so good on this, it's about conformity of the mind to reality. Mm. Right? The truth is outside of us. The truth is outside of us. It's not up here.
Mm.
I conform my mind to reality, and that's the apprehension of truth, of things. And so we've totally lost that in our modern and postmodern mentality, and that's why we try to control things and apprehend things, because we actually think this is the center.
And we don't let them speak to us. Right. We miss what the ancients saw.
Yeah.
And then the experience of the mountains becomes profoundly empty.
Yeah.
So when you're in the mountains now as a Christian, you know, and I hate when people are like, you know, I don't need to go to church, the mountains aren't my church. Yeah. Like, it's the biggest cop-out ever.
Totally.
And you're missing the whole worldview of the mountains that sees them as a gift, which is way better.
Yeah.
As opposed to a random happy assortment of molecules that has achieved some peaks that look pretty.
Yeah.
You know, what does it say to you now as a Christian up in the mountains? How does it speak to you?
Yeah.
And also, how do you overcome the obstacles? People don't hear it.
Yeah.
Because even if they're Christians, they're in this worldview that's scrubbed of all this.
Yeah.
How do we let it speak to us in the way that you do?
Yeah. That's a good one. That's a good question. So I think the first thing that happens when I go into the mountains, and again, you can get on I-70 and drive west into the Rockies, but you're still in an urbanized environment. You got to get off the trail a bit. Yeah. The first thing that happens is it seems to be that humanity, I recover my humanity. I literally feel human again. I got on the bike yesterday and just had to hammer. It was cold outside and rainy, but I was like, I got to get back in touch, because I'm just in my head and I'm sending emails and doing all this different stuff, and I got to just slow down and focus. And so there's something about physically doing something active that then kind of starts, we start to kind of recover a bit of the humanity of just the being human in a technological, in a digitalized age. So that's the first thing, is just the kind of, okay, I feel like I'm coming back to life a bit here. And that requires silence. It requires some stillness in the heart. And then everything starts to, of course, come out, manifest. So it's almost like it almost feels like medicinal, in a sense of like the creation just starts to work to bring us back human again. One of the things, another aspect of it is when we go into creation, we're seeing reality as a gift again. It doesn't feel like that in the cities of concrete and glass. It just feels like hectic. And I was just on I-25 coming down here. It's just crazy. Everybody's just all over the place. Where are we going? Why are we hustling everywhere? And all of a sudden you slow down, and you realize like this is all doesn't have to exist. This is all pure gift. Creation is gift. And so it kind of reattunes us to the reception of that. And then you start to realize, oh, I'm actually, when I immerse myself in creation, and I think this is what people get on a naturalistic level a lot, I actually feel received as gift again.
Hmm.
Like creation, it sounds almost pantheistic, but I think there's truth how God is working in it. I actually feel received and gifted, like I'm a gift in this world.
You're part of the thing.
I'm part of the thing. I'm in creation.
That's awesome.
And I am creation. So it's not just aspects of my humanity kind of recovering. It's actually, I'm coming back to the essence of everything, which is creatureliness. Like I am creature. And that sounds so weird to say it like that, but that means I'm actually contingent, I'm limited, I'm radically dependent, and that there's this source, this uncreated thing. Because God is not a being amongst beings. He is being, capital B. This is the metaphysics stuff. It's like metaphysics is the study of being, so how things are, what they are. God is the fullness of being. All things participate in that. And when you start to encounter the sheer magnitude of beings in creation, you're up on a mountaintop or you're sitting by the ocean, you see being in this kind of enormous and unthinkable way. It starts to open you up to that which cannot be known, which is God, apart from Christ, who comes into creation.
It's really liberating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because when you don't have that, it's the burden, you bear the burden of being God, that you... I've actually heard this summed up well, that the pre-modern world, there is a God. The modern world, I get to be God. The post-modern world, oh, man, I have to be God.
Hmm.
There's no meaning, so I'm therefore burdened with inserting meaning into everything that might not be there. How empty is that? But it's the posture of humility on top of the mountain. I get to be part of creation and get to enjoy it as a child.
Yeah.
That's true. That unlocks joy, doesn't it?
It is. Childlikeness, humility. This book was written primarily as a through hike on the Caro Trail with just guys. But I taught
my son Joey was there for part of it.
He was total stud. Total stud. Amazing. Crushed it. Yeah, he was with us for 4 days. So I had three guys that I through hiked it with, and then every 4 days, guys like your son would come on the Caro Trail. Usually I'd invite a young priest and he'd bring some guys. I think he was with Conroy. Father Sean?
Yeah, Father Sean, yeah.
So Joey came. There was like 12, 14 guys on that section, and they would come for a few days, and then they'd jump off the trail. And the book details these ridiculous crews, and it was pretty wild. But the point, we can go into that in a second, but the point here is to say, I have a whole chapter on the feminine, because my real training and my real work is not so much metaphysics, it's Mariology, so it's the study of Mary, especially Mary as the church. And Mary as the essence of creation.
I got to have you back to talk on that book.
Let's do it. That sounds
good.
For
real.
Yeah.
No,
that,
go ahead,
that's just what I interpret it, humility, receptivity, it's a Marian posture. It's a feminine posture towards God, which all of creation stands in this feminine posture towards God as gift and reception. But it that's what I think happens. Is like if we go into creation to praise the Father, and we're in Christ, we become more Marian.
Mm.
That's the mystery.
Because you're receiving?
Because you're receiving. You're
wow,
just receiving.
Beautiful.
You're just literally in a mode of pure reception.
Wow. You talked about, during this interview, but also in the book, about worldviews and a Catholic worldview. I've heard that said many times, but rarely heard people talk about that in a way that's like, okay, what does that actually mean?
Yeah.
And how does it make life better?
Yeah.
Can you spell it out a little bit and just tie some of the pieces together here for how this experience of nature and immersing yourself in it brings you into not just a natural worldview, but a truly Christian Catholic worldview?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the concept of a worldview is hard to get our heads around.
Yeah.
Because it's the most foundational and basic thing that anybody has. So a worldview is this set of values and ideas that together create this total vision of reality. Hmm. So the worldview is the deepest thing that's formed in somebody, and it's how, again, this kind of these values and ideas, how they kind of coalesce to and come to bear on my life. Basically, a way of putting it is, there's always presuppositions for what I'm doing, even if I don't know it. What I had for breakfast this morning, to the deep questions of who am I going to marry? Am I going to go to Mass on Sunday? Am I going to climb mountains or swim in the ocean? Like, it's not just I just doing things. It's there's this deep presuppositional part of my rational nature that is the worldview, and that is what informs all of my actions, and it's how I think about reality. So when Christ says metanoia, convert the mind, he's saying convert the worldview. That's what Paul is saying, and it's intimately connected to the body, because he says offer your body as a living sacrifice in Romans 12. Do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewal of your nous, of your mind. Not rationalizing. Nous is the Greek word for the mind and intuition, rest, contemplation. So that's the first thought on worldview for you.
You've experienced this a lot, and you spent your first part of your priesthood in campus ministry in Boulder.
Yeah.
There's kids who show up in campus ministry land.
Yeah.
And they go to church. And they might even be really excited about going to church. And they go to the Focus Seek conference and all that stuff, you know? But if you do the Catholic thing without a Catholic worldview, without a Christian worldview, spell out the difference there. What's the problem with that?
Oh, man. So I'm going to reveal something I've never said publicly before. When I was a college chaplain, I was just kind of looking the lay of the land. And I was like, who am I trying to get in relationship with? Because we can kind of all, remember that game Hungry Hungry Hippos?
Yeah.
I don't know if your kids ever played that.
It's a phenomenal game.
You throw the marbles out there and everybody just kind of attacks it.
Yeah.
That's kind of like the priest, the campus minister, focus missionaries. Everybody just kind of goes for the same 12 kids. I know this is bad. This is raw. You might want to edit this.
No, it's true. This is the landscape.
It's rough. It's bad. And so I'm like, we got to break out of this. And here's how we're going to do it. I'm going to start an outdoor club called Aquinas Alpine. And I'm going to start planning trips that all these college kids I want to go on. So, and I would plan them months in advance. And I wouldn't tell them about it usually until right before. So like 6 months in advance, I'd have to work out with my pastor covering masses for the weekend. And then like 36 hours before, I'd be like, anybody want to go canyoneering in Utah this weekend? And they'd be like, absolutely, because they're in college and you have infinite amount of time and resources. So I started doing these trips, but I had a crew of college kids that I said, this is what I'm looking for. There's three kinds of students. I called them locals, staples, and McCoys. McCoy is named after John McCoy, who had a huge conversion, but McCoys are like completely off the grid. They are not practicing. They have no interest in doing anything. They're the ones we have a hard time getting to. The locals are the solid, they're faithful. They might be socially awkward. They might not be. But what I want is the staples in the middle, who are friends with everybody. They know the McCoys. And they also know the locals. So I didn't want just a trip for our local population of the 15 kids who go to campus ministry for whatever reasons, which can kind of become, it can get too insulated. I wanted the staples who are attractive and compelling and interesting and had their foot outside so that they get the McCoys on the trip. So I would always tell them, I want a third of every trip. So bring them in. And the McCoys would be wild. I mean, there was some stuff that happened. I was like, okay, we have some crazy characters on this.
Yeah.
But that was kind of what the trips afforded, was it just broke us out of this mold. And then all of a sudden, you know, so John McCoy, for example, this guy who's now, I did his wedding and he's a great friend. He's got four kids.
Praise God.
Super faithful guy, amazing father. But he and I met on a 14er, and he and I talked all the way down about evolution, all the way down to peak. Way up, he wouldn't talk to me.
Wow.
Because it's like the priest.
Yeah.
And we had Mass at the top, and he was a fallen away Catholic. But all the way down, we just talked and talked and talked. And then that night, we sat around the fire and talked all night. And then, and so that kind of thing was what was happening in the mountains. And I just, it's like some of my greatest joys were just spending that time with them.
Wow.
But you gotta kind of be patient and just kind of be around them. And this is where as Christians, we got to really focus on what Ratzinger calls the art of being human. And I think you exemplify this personally in your ministry. It's like you gotta be normal. You gotta relate to him.
Yeah, thank you.
Humor, insight, thoughtfulness, but just that kind of steadiness of character, knowing who you are in Christ, being unassuming. I mean, these things, sometimes we overlook them and we want the kind of grandeur of sanctity and piety, but fundamental kindness and unassuming. I tell guys in seminary, I'm like, you do those two things, people are gonna love you.
Yeah.
You might be terrible as a homeless, but if you're those, you're human, they can relate to you, it goes a long way.
So a Christian worldview is about being real.
Yeah.
It's about being in touch with reality. Everything today is militating against that. Isn't that tragic?
Absolutely.
Which is why I love your whole mission and message here. It's to get to break away, literally, you just got to walk away from it all in order to touch reality again.
Yeah.
To discover the worldview of like, oh, I'm a creature. Because we forget even on that basic level, in large part because of our phones.
Yeah. So I think that there's a huge, I mean, we're living in such a just an unbelievable moment. I don't even think we realize the change that's happening among us. And then Elon Musk drops out of the future and is changing everything now. It's like crazy what the world that we find ourselves in. One of my concerns is not just reacting to the world. I don't want to react to the world and be like, phones are bad and become Luddites or something like that. But how do we integrate this and how do we think more deeply about the questions?
Yeah.
And one of the main pitfalls, and again, I think this is you're doing a lot of good work on this, is we're not immune to it, to the problems, the ideologies in the church, unless we're grounded in reality, which means creatureliness. So if Catholics are not living as creatures, we're going to fall victim to ideologies such as liberalism, such as radical traditionalism, you can go down the list of like the weirdness that happens when we lose touch with the reality. And that's why I think there's something about staying in the dirt and in the water and in the things of life that help us as Catholics to live an incarnational worldview, which is the key to everything, the incarnation.
Get outside.
Yep.
Put the phone down and get outside.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you could do this if you're in a big city.
Yeah.
Just take a little walk, man. Just have those, I'm talking to myself right now.
Yeah.
Have that hour that you decide, I will not look at my phone. I'll go outside. Even, like, I did this the other night. My dog had to go outside to go to the bathroom. I walk outside. I'm looking at my phone.
Yeah.
And the Lord it struck me in that moment. Just like, dude, put it down. Look up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got that nice yard with, like, little view of the valley. Yeah, and
great,
like,
yard.
I put the phone down. I just took a deep breath, like, oh, God is in this moment.
Yeah.
But without intentionality, I completely lose that, and I just lose myself in it all.
Yeah.
Man.
One of the things this phone does to us also is that it gives us a heightened sense of self-importance. So I have to be sending text messages. And one of the things I did when I went on the Caro Trail was I had this auto-reply in my email. And this ticked a lot of people off, but it was fantastic. I wrote... So let's say you email me, this is July of 2022, and you get a response that says, I am through hiking the Caro Trail for the month of July. When I return on August 1st, I will delete every email in this inbox.
Yeah!
If you need to get a hold of me, reach out to me after August 1st. And you know what happened? Everything was fine. Western civilization continued without me sending email for a month. But we get this sense of like, oh, the seminary's probably going to fall apart because I'm so important. I'm so indispensable to everything, my immediate communication to everything. Now, I'm not saying we should get rid of our phones, but I am just saying it was a good reminder of like, oh, things just kind of moved on. Like people just, they figured out answers to their problems.
There were solutions. I love that. I'm going to do that. Yeah. I'm going to do that because the reality is when you don't do that, what you're saying to everybody is I'm going to pay a penalty for being away for a week.
Yep.
By being bombarded with 3,000 emails.
Yep.
You're the second person I know that's done that. The first is Bob Rice, where I've emailed Bob Rice, got a response. I'm not here, and I will not read this email.
Yeah.
Email me back in 2 weeks if you think this is important.
Yeah. I love it.
Oh, man, that's tremendous. Okay, two more questions.
Yeah.
One, scariest moment in the mountains. Because one of the great things it does is humble you to be in creation, man. Right? I'm an ocean lover. There's the awareness that if things go sideways in 90 seconds, I'm dead.
You're toast.
You know, I might lose consciousness under that wave. And but that there's something about that maybe it's a death wish, I don't know what it is, right? That draws you to that, and the experience and that slight danger.
Yeah.
A little bit of infinity, right?
Yeah.
Oh God, this is somewhere the mountains and ocean overlap. Sorry, just
I love it.
Brain's
yeah.
going
I love
here.
It. Love it.
And why the Lord, I think, preach in front of a sea. Unlike the sky, which is an image of infinity, you can't touch the sky. But a mountain and an ocean point to mystery and infinity and something bigger than us, but you can actually go there and touch the tip of it or climb the mountain.
Yeah.
And that's the incarnation. It's God who's touched down.
I love that. And I think that heights and depths also, we're hitting to the extremities of creation.
Yeah.
So we're climbing to the top of mountains, looking up at skies, going to the depths, into the sea.
Hmm.
I mean, when you start really kind of pulling the strings together of all of this in creation or in scripture, you realize it's like this is really in the consciousness of the covenantal mind of how we think about creation in the Jewish world and the Christian.
Yeah.
So it really is about kind of moving through the expansiveness of things.
And then you realize you're something bigger than you.
Yeah.
And the humbling, that's where it was. Most humbling, scary moment in the mountains.
Lightning storm on top of Antero Peak. Should never have been up there. Yeah, 14er. This is after my conversion. The prefrontal cortex was not fully formed at this point. I was like 18 with my buddy Nate. And he and I went to class first period. I think it was like calculus or whatever. And we're like, this is lame. Let's skip the rest of the day. Let's go climb a peak. So we left school. But this is like early season. So this is like in May.
Mm.
And weather's kind of touchy. And so we drive out there. It's a couple hours, and then we start climbing at about 11 o'clock in the morning, which is, you should be down, almost back to tree line, if not out of there by then. Storm's rolling in. We keep pushing for the summit. Why? Because we're 18 and we're totally invincible. Absolutely nothing bad can happen to us. And we get to the top, and there's so much static electricity in the air that we can feel the it's shocking. There's metal in our boots, and it's shocking our feet. His girlfriend was with us, and the metal was shocking her. From her earrings was shocking.
Oh, that's terrifying.
We had poles that just lit up. I mean, it was like something out of a X-Men movie or something. We just threw them down. But by this point, the storm is breaking on us, and we're at the summit of the mountain because we're absolutely idiotic, in what we're doing. And so then the first boom hits, and it was I've been around lightning above tree line before. I don't think there's anything more terrifying, but that boom was so powerful and the lightning was so close that it like shocked us and blinded us. And I just remember like falling to the ground and how we didn't get hit because we were the highest thing. We were on top of the peak. And then we started to run.
Could also kill you through the granite.
Yeah. So then we started to just run down the mountain as fast as we could, and you could just feel it. And, so that was absolutely the most terrifying moment of my life and should have died. I mean, that was by the mercy of God.
Humbling.
Yeah.
Talk about being a creature in creation and not God in that moment.
Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah.
Okay, then the last question. What do you say to the person watching who says, nature's my church.
Yeah.
God is everywhere. Why do I need to go to a church?
Yeah. I would say because you're a human person.
Huh.
And because God didn't just become a mountain. He became a man. Huh. And men, humanity, live in relationship to each other. That's the only way that we can experience something that none of creation can express, which is actual interpersonal love. And so God's method is to become man, and then to draw all men to himself. He becomes the new Adam. And that humanity, supernatural humanity in God's grace, is the church. The church is not buildings. The church is not kind of dressing up and doing different things. All of that's at the service of transforming our humanity, especially our hearts, to open them completely to God. So if you weren't a human, if you were an antelope or a moose, I'd say, yeah, you're good. The creation can be the church for the moose. It can't be for a human person.
Wow. That's profound.
That's my first thought.
That's a great first thought,
thank
man.
You.
Really. There's an escape. It's individualistic. Well, you said you became selfish.
Yeah.
To say I'll do the spiritual thing on my terms, but that also translates when people go to church and it becomes a maybe more agenda driven experience of church, that's uber left or uber right or uber traditionalist or what, it becomes about the trappings, and forgets the experience of humanity together in Christ.
Yeah.
That's a non-human experience as well. You know, it's obviously closer to the reality.
Yeah.
But it's dehumanized.
It is.
And that's what our whole generation is drawn to right now. I just was reading studies about the people who are leaving Catholicism. For every 100 people that enter, 800 or so leave. Mm-hmm. And there's some people saying, well, don't you see, like, there's this more traditional stuff's exploding and everybody's drawn to that, and there's a truth there. But the vast majority of people are not becoming, if they don't find Christianity, they're not going to they're not going to Muslim, they're not going to something that they're not drawn to that.
Right.
What they're drawn to is, it's not even the nuns anymore where they're saying, I'm not religious. They're being drawn to, I'm vaguely spiritual, I might even call myself Christian, but there's no embodiment in connection with real humans.
Yeah.
It's about something, a system that I'm doing on my terms. It's either nature or on my app, and that's it. Stops there.
Yeah.
But there's a thread here between all these poisons.
I
could just open up an entire other hour, maybe.
I know, we could go forever. But I will say on that point, I was talking to somebody recently about this, and I said, we need to live our Catholic faith not... It's not so much about being spiritual as it is about being incarnational.
Hmm.
I think sometimes we use this spiritual becomes over-spiritualizing. We're playing into the zeitgeist, the
spirit of the age,
spirit of the age, by over-spiritualizing the faith. The great temptation of the Catholic faith has always been Gnosticism since the very beginning, to reduce it to this kind of spirit, this knowledge, this idea. And I see a lot of that kind of playing out. And what we just need is just good old-fashioned incarnational life, which means that you're finding God in the ordinary human things, and you're attentive to Him in the reality of creation. I tell my guys in seminary all the time, they always complain about the traffic if they're not from Denver, which I'm like, I was here before there was traffic. So
I remember. I was here,
yeah,
too.
You remember that?
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. You could go anywhere in the city. And I always tell them, I said, just remember, you're not in traffic, you are traffic. I'm like, you are. So you're not in creation, you are creation.
Mm.
That's the kind of example I use. So I think that creatureliness, living that out in the practice of our Catholic faith, which can be everything from practically just living in the dirt and in the water and in reference to the mountains and putting the screens down, to actually thinking more deeply about how God communicates Himself to us. Mm. What does it mean that He became incarnate? That wasn't just a thing that happened 2,000 years ago. That's the very method and the very structure by which He continues to reveal and be in relationship to us.
And in the dirt and the water of each other, and of the sacraments, and all of it here.
Exactly.
It's all the same thing, you know? Like we make these false distinctions between, like, there's creation and there's grace. And God's like, no. All of it's coming out of my being at every nanosecond.
Yeah.
Enjoy the whole thing.
Exactly.
Don't pick one or the other. It's all Him.
Yeah.
Thanks for embodying that, living it. Thanks for taking this took time. Yeah. I was reading this and realizing, okay, this is not something you do off the top of your head. So thanks for sinking your heart into this. How do people get this book, by the way? To Heights and Unto Depths, Letters from the Colorado Trail.
So it's available on Amazon, Ignatius.com, if you want to support Ignatius Press directly. And there'll be an audio version coming out in the next few months. So if you're looking for that, grateful. Thanks so much for being with you.
Oh, man. Thank you, brother. Thank you. Yeah. It's great to be with you, dude. Seriously, thank you. It's a gift. I want to close with this beautiful quote from St. Augustine. He said, question the beauty of the earth. Question the beauty of the sea. Question the beauty of the air. And he goes on with a list of things we should question. The sun, the moon shining its rays, the animals that move in the waters and amble about in dry land. Question all these things. They all answer you. Here we are. Look, we're beautiful. Their beauty is their confession. Who made these beautiful, changeable things if not the one who is beautiful and unchangeable? Be sure to unplug, close your devices, look at nature, question, let it speak to you, let it form you as a Christian and as a human. Thank you again to our missionaries of joy, and be sure to sign up for our daily anchor and for our newsletter. We have so many exciting things coming out to help you become a fuller Christian and a fuller human, including, stay tuned for this, we're going to be leading a pilgrimage to beauty, me and my bride, and I'm going to hopefully rope Father Neppel in on this, to Hawaii. So anyway, you'll find out about all those things if you sign up for our newsletter below this video. I love you guys. Thank you so much for being with us. See you next time.